Welcome to A Handful of Dust. This is a podcast about Neil Gaiman's The Sandman comic, when we're trying to cover all of the collected editions in the various individual trades. I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny. We're going to start out with a content note again. We'll probably do this before every episode, but again, it's in these early books there's some stuff that comes up. So some of these comics deal with dark and troubling subject matters, and we will probably refer to them or maybe discuss them a little bit in depth as we talk about the comic books. So if you want more information about the stuff that's in the books and the stuff that we might cover in this, if you look at the description for this episode, there should be some, there will be some more information there for you.
So this is episode 2, volume 2, The Doll's House, which collects issues 9 to 16 of The Sandman. Yep. I guess we are in 1989 and 1990. Do you want to tell us what the brief synopsis of The Doll's House is?
Yeah, I will try. So The Doll's House follows a character called Rose, who is a young woman, and we see her travelling across to Britain to meet family, and then we see her travel back to America to try and find some more family. So in the first instance, it is a grandmother that she didn't know about, and in the second instance, it's her little brother who's been sort of missing. There's sort of a slightly complicated reason as to why he's been missing, but she hasn't seen him in a while. And all the way along, we're meeting more characters, and we're sort of finding out that Rose might be quite significant to Dream and the Dreaming. And we sort of find out a lot about her and about the Dreaming, I think, through this book. And by the end of it, we also learn a little bit more about another one of the Endless. We meet Desire. In fact, I think we meet them really early on.
Yes, we meet them in the second issue of this particular collection, don't we?
Yeah, but we find out a lot more about who they are in the final issue. So yeah, that's a very brief
yeah, it is.
Overview
so,
of,
that's
the,
all right.
of the Doll's House.
So the Doll's House, we'll find out more about, we'll meet two more of the Endless. Last time, obviously, we met Dream and Death. We'll meet two more in this volume. And as you say, we'll get a story that ostensibly, thank goodness in a way, is more about the characters, about human characters walking around in the real world than it is about Dream. Because as we said last time, he's a pretty sort of, he's a difficult character to like, isn't he?
He is.
Yes.
And I think, well, you mentioned this already, or you mentioned this off microphone, shall we say, off recording, that in, particularly in the first issue, we sort of have trouble with him. So I don't know. Do you want to talk about issue one? Because it's kind of like The Sound of Her Wings. It's sort of a, well, actually there's two in this book, but there's a sort of standout thing that doesn't quite fit the Rose narrative that I just talked about.
So we get a prologue called A Tale in the Sand, which is about a young man who's going through some sort of initiation ritual, which I guess is with the sort of, I guess it's a tradition for the village he lives in Africa, where he has to go out into mm-hmm. the desert with an elder and he has to discover something and be told a story. And it seems, in a way, possibly a completely isolated story for the rest of the volume and for the rest of The Sandman, except of course it isn't, is it? Because we will see a depiction of Dream in this story, and we will find out that the character they refer to as, I believe, Kaichul the Endless or Kaichul the yep. Deathless is Dream, and that he's done something fairly terrible again to a woman that he was in love with.
Yeah. So we meet Nada in the Hell episode, yes. a Hell issue of the first book. And she's introduced, I don't know, she's sort of glossed over, but there's clearly a past between her and Dream. And we get the sense that she is imprisoned in Hell on his word. And in this book, in this issue, A Tale of Sand, it starts out in this sort of rich and interesting sort of bit of folklore or like history, like oral history, shall we say, like being passed down through storytelling about this queen, Nada, and a love affair with Dream. And it's sort of, as you're reading it, you're like, well, how does this story match up with what we might already know from the first book? And of course, it's sort of revealed that, well, it's like, I think it's maybe the first time we see how bad Dream is at relationships.
Yes.
And we find out that she was, while also in love with him, I know, there's an implication that he actively pursues her, shall we say, in a
stalky,
the kindest way possible. Yeah, in a slightly problematic way. He pursues her and she does fall in love, but sees that their love is possibly not allowed in some like greater way. And she sees her kingdom being punished for her love, basically. And so at the end here, she commits suicide. And after that, there is still more. Dream offers her the position of like queen of dreaming. Is that right? Yep. He sort of offers her. Yeah. He says, you can come and be queen with me. And she's like, no, a love is not meant to be. Or, you know, she sort of gives the like rational maybe answer of like, no, this is not supposed to happen. I'm human, even though in death. And so he curses her to hell, which is a natural response. I'm sure everyone does in relationships when they break up, is to send your lover to hell. There's sort of, yeah, not a great ending and not a great indication of who Dream is. But this character flaw that will carry on throughout the whole of the run, that he is bad at relationships.
He's terrible at relationships.
He does keep trying. Yes. So that is something.
He does keep trying and he does seem to have relationships with humans, and he is pretty terrible at them, and he mopes afterwards and he acts in terrible, really quite awful ways. And
it's framed, I think we sometimes see this story framed as like him being wronged as well. There's sort of this understanding that like she didn't love like his first great love and she didn't love him enough, kind of. There's that sort of element to this. I don't think that's not how this story portrays it. This portrays it pretty honestly that, yeah, it was him not accepting no, kind of, you know, in a way, not accepting the breakup and punishing her for the breakup, which is sadly not an uncommon relationship problem to have. I think that is a thing that happens. It's like, yeah, it's one of his character flaws, I think. Yes. And here is illuminated quite well.
Yes, and he does, as this anthropomorphic personification of Dream, he does have this all-too-human characteristic of, or flaw of, you know, being horrible about broken up or former lovers. And it's again this idea that although he's the title character, the Sandman, this book is about him in a way, that he's not a great guy. He's not a pleasant character. No. And actually, one of the things that happens throughout the run is I almost feel much more comfortable when he's just the background character in the stories and the other characters are all much more engaging and interesting. And of course he does crop up as a sort of background character, but you know, the ones where he doesn't turn up for ages, those are my favorites in a way. And it also, it does that thing, because this is the prologue, it does that thing which we'll talk about more when we get to Dream Country, where you get these standalone stories. A bit like The Sand of the Wings, this one, A Tale in the Sand, the four stories that are in Dream Country, which we'll be talking about next time. And later on, I think Fables and Recollections, where you get these standalone stories, which at first glance or first reading, you just think, oh, that's a pretty good story. But how does it relate to the whole run? But of course, they all do fit in, don't they? They all reveal a bit more about Dream and the Endless.
They do.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about characters in this one, because we've got lots of interesting characters. We've got Rose Walker particularly, who's a great character, leading the story, finding out that she's got family that she didn't know about, connecting with a grandmother she wasn't aware of, and then going on the hunt. I think she ends up in San Francisco by the looks of that house, is it? Somewhere like that. So she ends up back in America on the hunt for her younger brother, Jed, who... Interestingly, this is a callback. He was the dream boy from Jack Kirby and Joe Simon's Sandman run. All the adventures.
Oh, I didn't realize that even Jed was the callback there. I thought it was just the surrounding characters.
Jed is a callback. So in the Simon and Kirby Sandman, the dream dimension was in Jed's dreams, and Brute and Glob were characters in that comic as well. Neil Gaiman, as he does, is recycling.
Picks up some people along the way. I only thought that the Sandman character was the reference. I didn't realize that they all were a reference there. Yeah, so shows me paying attention.
No, it's all right, because I think that the good thing about it, in a way, as we talked last time with, you know, when Neil Gaiman refers to mythologies we're not familiar with, that you can read the comic without knowing these background details.
Yeah.
All you know is, in a way, is that Rose Walker's got a little brother. He's somewhere trapped in an awful situation. And part of the narrative of A Doll's House, or The Doll's House, is her trying to find him and be reunited with her brother. But of course, there's some mysterious stuff going on in the dream, in something about a dream vortex that we're told about. And there's also various other stories going on as well in here. So it's great for, you know, this one felt to me, I was, although there's very sort of difficult, problematical moments, which we'll get to, in particular one issue.
Mm-hmm.
But this one felt much more like, oh yeah, now we're off now with the stories. We're going to get stories.
Yeah, definitely.
We've done the origin.
It's sort of, yeah, and we're sort of swept up in this like closed narrative. We're following this character, and we're getting all these little threads of stuff to collect up. So I think the first thing we'll sort of, I don't know if we want to like talk about the way the characters like set themselves up in the whole run, but we meet Rose, and Rose is the granddaughter of Unity Kincaid from book one, and it's established that in book one that Unity has been raped while she was asleep, and that the child born is Rose's mother. So there's this sort of like thread that catches through the books, and we'll also find out later in this run that Rose's friend was Judy from book one as well. And of course, we're introduced to another character called Barbie, who, if you listen to A Game of You, you know about Barbie as well, because she'll become a character later. So there's these like, and I wonder if now I'm saying them out loud, like whether these connections are all through women, or maybe that's just because there's the ones I notice. But there is this very, I think it's a sort of satisfying like collection of characters to have this sort of like continuity throughout. The whole run, and we'll meet, there are some other characters in the Doll's House that we will meet who will become characters in later episodes as well. So yeah, I think there's the introduction of characters in this book become like they all become much more significant as we go along. And I think the first one is probably Desire, because like you said, we meet them in book two. And so Desire is another one of the Endless. And I don't know, like, I feel like I now know who the Endless are, but I don't know if at this point I really understood who the Endless were, or how many there were, or even that all their names began with D. I don't know if I'd really clicked that together yet when I first read this. So we've already met Dream and Death, and in this book we meet Desire and Despair briefly.
Yes.
And we sort of learn their little, both their visual language, their text language, the way their words are written on the page, and we also learn their personalities. We've met Death, and we talked about that in the last episode, about how Death's character like fills up this space in the book, and then Desire adds this like rogue element to things. So yeah, I don't know if you
talk
more about Desire.
I think it's fascinating because, you know, it's difficult in a way to put ourselves back to issue 10 of The Sandman, when we didn't know there was going to be the Endless, that there were going to be all these various personifications of different aspects of life, and that they would all begin with a D. We get this hint in a couple of panels here where we see Desire standing in what they will refer to as their gallery, and it's got various signs or sigils to represent their brothers and sisters in the Endless. So it's you know, as you say, we meet two more D's, we meet Desire and Despair, and we get a hint that there's going to be more as well. So we're slowly filling in the Endless, which is fascinating. And Desire, of course, we refer to Desire quite correctly as they, because Desire is portrayed as
they're a gender fluid character, I think we can sort of say. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of clear in the way that this was written that maybe, I mean, and also just knowing that that language wasn't quite there in the late 80s, early 90s. So the pronoun used in this book is it for Desire, but I think we're much more comfortable to use they.
They seems right, because, you know, Desire, yeah. Desire's representation.
I think Neil Gaiman was writing this now, I would probably expect to see a gender-neutral pronoun, or to use they for them. Yeah, we're introduced to this sort of like gender fluid, sexually fluid character who embodies desire. I thought of never really, I mean, we're not, I think the book is not designed to make you like desire as much as you like death, say, or any of the other endless. But I think there's a great quote. I don't know if it's in the book or whether it was in an essay or something, that desires, whereas dream lives in the dreaming, this sort of slightly magical, fantastical world, desire has their citadel. I think it's referred to as the citadel, or the threshold, which is like a giant version of themselves. And it's, they live in like the heart. And it's, I think, I definitely remember this Neil Gaiman quote about like, for him, it was obvious that desire needs to live under the skin, and this sort of very like human or like feeling, very visceral almost, in a way that like the other characters are maybe not, the other endless are not. So yeah, desire is a really interesting character. If they weren't so terrible, they'd be one of my favorites, but
yes,
they're pretty terrible. And I think in this issue too, I'm pretty sure in the discussion with Despair, we'll find out about Nada. Yes, we do. We do. So we find out that Desire was basically responsible for Dream and Nada's love affair, and that Desire has some kind of like desire to put Dream in awkward situations, or like put, like bring about Dream's death, maybe, or like just stir in shit, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, Despair.
You know, like it doesn't. It's not really clear, I think, at this point.
Despair says at one point that the Elder Three don't play our little games.
Yeah,
and we're not quite sure who the Elder Three are, other than that we know probably, you know, two of them are going to be Dream and Death. But this idea that Desire and, to a lesser extent, Despair, that they are trying in some ways to interfere with their siblings, to play them, to create scenarios and difficulties for them, and that this Desire in particular gets some form of amusement from this and is looking again, you know, they've interfered in the past and they're looking to interfere again, it seems.
Yeah.
So that creates story tension, and that's great. And we get this idea, as you say, there's more of the endless to come,
which is a very exciting prospect.
Yeah, it is.
Because I know two of the three that haven't been introduced are like some of my favorites. So it's kind of like fun to read this back and be like, oh, we haven't met them yet, but they're going to be great.
Yes, there's two characters to come who are going to be really great.
Yeah.
And you're quite right that desire lives in the threshold, the fortress of desire. And it's like a sort of, again, like a human figure, a sexless, gender fluid human figure. But the heart is exposed almost in a surgical fashion with the skin pulled back because desire.
It's a really good visual. It's like this sort of opening pages of the second issue in this book. It's really good. It's like very, this is sort of, I think we've talked about how like this book feels more like The Sandman than the previous book, but this, the artwork here feels more like it as well. And it's like the same artists, I believe, same basic team as
I think
half of the first book.
Yes, that's right. I love that Desire is portrayed, it's quite 80s, you know, Desire looks like a character from a Duran Duran album cover or something like that.
Sort of made up, sort of short hair, wearing a suit.
Cheekbones,
yeah.
Yeah.
And also that their text has these like little, I don't really know how to describe it. It's almost like the way the font is stylized is like little hearts.
Yes.
Almost like not cutesy, but like it's sort of almost art deco-y, maybe like that slightly exaggerated. And Desire has Despair, who we meet briefly, has this sort of like slightly more raggedy speech bubble format, which again, I think becomes part of their identities as well. So yeah, that's Desire's introduction and Despair's brief introduction.
Yes.
And then there's Rose.
So Rose Walker,
we'll probably talk about a lot.
Is fascinating. She's a great character.
She is a great character.
And she's on this, as we've said, she's on this sort of mission.
Elaborate road journey, yes. Almost.
And particularly, I mean, she has her adventure in England, first of all, where she meets Unity, her grandmother, and she also will find the actual literal doll's house. Plus, I've forgotten that she also has a brief encounter with the Furies, the kindly ones.
The kindly ones again pop up. yeah, she meets them, and they're sort of, I mean, like, I'm sort of the Neil Gaiman representation of the kindly ones is kind of the one I know, but I know that they are like a sort of archetype, sort of folkloric archetype, as like oracles or like warners, like people who foretellers of misfortune kind of thing. Like, they are sort of enigmatic in that way, so they're here to sort of almost warn her and like, or maybe manipulate the situation. They're never, you know, they don't quite, they're not quite removed from the story. They have a, like a sort of presence. They affect things deliberately, it seems.
They speak in riddles, and like a lot of sort of fantasy or fairy tale characters, or, you know, mythology characters, they have certain rules, don't they?
They have this three questions rule.
Only, which is very sort of storybook fairy tale type thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when Rose gets to Moving In, which is the third issue in this collection. I'm going to say San Francisco, that it looks like. I may be wrong because of the design of the house. But she moves into...
Yeah.
It feels like this is real Neil Gaiman, the Sandman. We get Rose Walker, a character who's portrayed with sort of multicolored hair, moving into a shared house. And she has a landlord, and we meet the other residents of the house, and they've all got their own little quirks and characteristics. And this is where, I think when we talked about A Game of You, we said about Neil Gaiman, he doesn't seem to waste characters. He'll keep them. And, you know, Barbie, who's almost, is almost a joke because her boyfriend or husband is called Ken, and, you know, they make a joke about it. She's just like a minor character, but she'll become much more important in a later book that we'll come back to, because it's going to be a fun one to talk about again.
Yeah, he doesn't waste characters, and like, they're a really interesting bunch of characters. They're sort of not, you don't find out everything about them. I mean, Barbie probably will find out more about her, but the others are sort of left a little bit on the fringes, which, I don't know, it's quite nice, almost.
Yeah, you get Hal the landlord, who's great. You get Chantel and Zelda, the spider women, who actually, having said he doesn't waste characters, I would have loved those to have come back at some point to find out more about the spider women, who we're never sure if they're lovers or sisters or mother and daughter. It's not, I don't think, clear, is it?
I feel like when I read the dreaming sequence with them that happens later, it feels more like their relationship is depicted as a romantic one.
As a couple, yes.
Yeah, and like, because it sort of separates them and gives them separate identities that make them feel more like people who have found each other than people who are already family, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're really wonderful, and then Barbie and Ken is this sort of throwaway joke almost that we'll come back to later. And then Gilbert,
who's lovely, who's portrayed, drawn based on G.K. Chesterton, the author, and he's a lovely character in his caped coat and his walking stick, his glasses on a chain, and a lovely hat, and he'll become quite an important character. And while we're sort of mentioning Gilbert, we probably should mention this idea that when Dream returned to his realm at the end of the last book, and they had a sort of accounting of the dreaming. And there are certain elements or characters or, should we call them dreams and nightmares?
Dreams, yeah. I mean, and this is in book two, isn't it? We see Lucien.
Yes.
He's another character we get introduced to, the librarian of dreaming, doing the count and revealing that some dreams and or nightmares have gone missing.
And some dreams or nightmares are somehow in the waking world. And have gone missing, and it's a concern for the Dream himself. Yeah, Lucien's great. We saw him very briefly in the first volume, and he's the librarian of the Dream Inn. He catalogues all the books that have never been written, but only written in dreams. Mm-hmm. He's another horror host from an old DC comic, I'm afraid.
I didn't know that either.
So, yeah, Lucien is a callback character, and so is Dream's Raven. Because this is the first time we get introduced to the idea
Matthew.
Dream has a raven, and that it has a voice, and that it has a name, and that Matthew is the raven, and he's a callback character to Swamp Thing, I'm afraid.
They're all callbacks.
Well, interestingly, I think a lot of the male...
Including Cain and Abel, the oldest callback, shall we say, who were actually... They were in book one, and we didn't really mention them in book one, but yeah, Cain and Abel. But they are both a callback to the Bible.
Yep.
And also a callback to another DC, right?
Yes, to two DC comics, Tales of Mystery and Tale... No, House of Mystery and House of Secrets. And they were the horror hosts for those comics. And yeah, so, you know, not only does he not waste any characters, he looks to reuse and recycle characters as well and bring them back.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I think a lot of the male characters seem to be, you know, recycled from past comics. But a lot of the female characters seem new and much more interesting and exciting. And they're going to be, what do we call it, foreshadowing. They're going to be referenced later on and they're going to become much more important. So we got this lovely setup. She's in this house. She's hunting for her little brother. Various dreams are walking the world. And there's a dream vortex and something weird is happening behind it all.
And I think pretty early on it's established that she is the dream vortex, right? Like,
yes, I think...
We learn that she has a sort of, like, ability to to infiltrate dreams, basically. Because we see this, like, narrative of Lucian counting and Morpheus dream talking to him. And it's like she is the eyes through which we're viewing this situation, which I've always really liked. The sort of Lucian turns around and looks at her and looks like straight out of the comic at you.
Yes.
So yeah, we know that she is, like, there's a reason we're following her, you know, that we know that stuff is going to, like, come out and stuff is going to happen, but I don't think we know exactly what at that stage.
Yeah, she's right. So she is going to be the dream vortex, whatever that is. We know it's something that doesn't happen very often, and when it does happen, it's bad, and Dream has to do something about it. Some sort of weird existential glitch in the dreaming system, I guess. But when he looks into it, of course, he finds out more. He's interested that Jed does not seem to exist apart from in the dreaming somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And also we get, I think, possibly the first references to a character or a nightmare, I guess, called the Corinthian. Who is a terrifying character. I was talking on my other podcast to Julia Round about Misty and girls' comics, and she talks about vampire archetypes. And I know in one of her books, she sees the Corinthian coded as vampire, particularly with the biting.
Yeah.
A terrible, scary nightmare, literally a nightmare character.
Yeah. I mean, if you were setting out to make a truly terrifying nightmare, which I guess Neil Gaiman was, then... Well done.
Yeah.
Did it.
Well done. Yeah, something that disturbs really our dreams.
Yeah.
So, going to pause the story for a minute, because in the middle of this run, we get, which must be, let's have a look, 9, 10, 11, 12. So, there must be issue 13 of Sandman, Men of Good Fortune. And we get, again, another one of these sort of seemingly unconnected interludes or prologues or epilogue stories that seems like a standalone story, where we introduce, or Neil Gaiman introduces, a character called Hob Gadlin.
Yeah. Who, again, I think is another sort of fan favourite, because he doesn't reoccur very often, but he does reoccur in the run.
And
I believe
he's just a man who decides he's not going to die.
Yeah.
And because he's been observed by Dream and Death, when he makes this pronouncement in some sort of medieval pub that he's in, they decide to take him up on his offer as a sort of wager, a game between them, in a sense. And he is a fan favorite character. He will appear a few times during the run, but it's a lovely standalone issue, and introduces at the end of the issue the idea that Dream might possibly be able to make male friendships. Or even just friendships.
Yeah.
And Hob Gadlin at one point... Basically, Hob Gadlin's immortal, and every 100 years he goes back to the same pub, and Dream comes back to meet him once every 100 years. And along the way, Neil Gaiman introduces a few other characters, including William Shakespeare, we should say.
Yes.
But also this idea that maybe a forerunner of John Constantine, an ancestor of John Constantine called Joanna Constantine... Who will crop up in a later story. But
I believe there's a reference to Mad Hetty as well, who's briefly in book one.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
Who's another immortal character who will come up again.
And then there's this suggestion that Hob Gadlin makes to him, and I think the penultimate meeting in this issue, which is, you're here as my friend. And Dream is completely affronted at the idea that he might need a friend.
Yeah, he accuses him of, says, "You dare to call me lonely." He's like very, grumpy.
Very grumpy.
He's so grumpy.
He is. He's so miserable. Mm. But it does end up with one panel of, one moment of Dream being a better character, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I guess he's learned something from his years of imprisonment, that he's like finally going to come back and meet him again, meet Hob again, and say, "Yeah, we are friends."
Yes.
You were right. I do want friends.
I have always heard it was impolite to keep one's friends waiting. Yeah.
Yeah.
In his characteristic black text boxes.
Super 80s look as well.
Oh, he's very 80s with his leather overcoat. His leather
the most
overcoat.
80s he's ever looked. And like, yes. Hob is sitting in like a very yuppie like wine bar, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, comes in looking like an 80s punk.
He does, yes. Looking Neil Gaiman had worn a long leather overcoat.
Yeah, we didn't really mention that at the beginning, but was Dream based on Neil Gaiman, or did Neil Gaiman grow into look like Dream? Like, massive black hair, always wearing black,
always
very
dressed
pale.
In black.
There's a sort of, which probably will make every time we refer to him as like a deeply flawed character be a little bit mean.
Well, it's slightly weird because he writes this character for 75 issues and beyond. You know, he's written more since then, that in a way looks like him. You know, tall, thin, pale, lots of black hair, lots of black clothing. And yet the character is completely problematic throughout.
Yeah.
You know, he only has occasional moments where he appears to show compassion and, I suppose humanity is the wrong word because he isn't human, of course. Mm. But, you know, unlike Death, who just seems the most, in a way, most humane and normal and charming character in the whole series. But yeah, it's fascinating, you know, how Neil Gaiman came up. Did the artist say, "Oh, we'll base it on him"? Or, but yeah, 80s Sandman, 80s Morpheus or Dream is, it's a strong look, isn't it?
It really is.
Okay, so that's a great issue in the middle of this book. And then, of course, we get to difficulties, I'm afraid, Jenny, don't we?
Straight into the bad issue.
Yeah, we had a bad issue last time.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if this one is better or worse. I think they are probably about equally matched.
So this is the issue called Collectors.
Yeah.
It's, in a way, it's almost, you know, it's like a jokey reference to the idea that there might be a convention for that horrific idea of serial killers. And there's like a joke at the start where they've called it, they've decided for the convention to spell it as in, like, you know, breakfast cereal or crop cereal. But, you know, they know it's actually a convention for serial killers. And I was wondering about, Silence of the Lambs and when that came out. And when we got introduced to this idea that I think until then had probably been only been used in sort of like FBI and criminal psychology terms.
Yeah.
Of the serial killer. And this idea in popular culture, particularly in films and since, of course, in television.
That podcasts.
And podcasts, yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
That serial killers are somehow interesting and, what's the word? I don't know, gripping, I guess, for us, even though it's the most awful, this is an issue about the most awful people in the world.
I think it's really interesting. I was thinking about that today, that we have, I think now definitely we have like a super saturation of this serial killer archetype, and I think there's a lot of people who are really interested and fascinated by those narratives, both real and fictional, and they're sort of everywhere. So this is not like, that element is not quite unique now. But I would say personally, I don't like enjoy that stuff so much. Like, I definitely have watched some serial killer stuff, and I definitely have like enjoyed some crime dramas and stuff. But I feel like now I really have a very low tolerance for it and find them to be quite grim. Even like, you know, the most sort of like average TV.
Yes.
Like the ones where they're always after, you know, like even that, I'm just like, actually I find this like quite grim and upsetting to watch, even though it's sort of designed as sort of prime time TV. So in this book, it sort of, yeah, it becomes like a stick out of like, I don't really need these characters explained to me because I'm very familiar with the archetype. And I don't know, like you said, maybe this was the turning point when serial killer became a real, I mean, if we're talking pop culture, the idea of a serial killer has been around since, I guess, Jack the Ripper, and has had like waves. You know, who's the guy who inspires Psycho? Ed Gein,
yeah.
Yeah. We have like sort of cycles where it comes and goes and back into fashion. And I guess, yeah, probably Silence of the Lambs is the equivalent here, where we're talking about this kind of serial killer. And it's the sort of the grittiness, the like visceralness has become part of the story. Whereas I feel like, you know, in, for example, Psycho, the Hitchcock, you don't really get the sense of like the cutting up of the bodies or the like, you know, that sort of element, which was part of Ed Gein's storyline, I believe. But, you know, it's sort of tempered for popular culture. Whereas this is like, we're going to lay it all out on the table. We are going to like literally give you every nitty gritty. And I think that's the huge problem with this issue, is it gets way too graphic, literally. I think we talked like in the last episode about whether something is more graphic because you're reading it in a comic book. And I think here it is both more graphic because you're reading it in a comic book, and also graphic.
Yes.
Also kind of, I think all of the elements, there's these sort of like red tone flashbacks to, we sort of learn about each individual serial killer and their like patterns and their victims. And there's these little red toned backgrounds. And I think we should probably talk about the one that is the worst.
Yes,
straight up, which is the depiction of a serial killer who hunts and kills preoperative transgender people. In the book, they're referred to as transsexual, but I think transgender would be the more accurate term nowadays. And it's really horrible. It's extremely horrible. And I think we have talked about this in A Game of You, and we'll probably talk about it again when we revisit A Game of You, but like, Neil Gaiman is capable of writing a very good representation of a trans woman, still flawed, but we know that that is possible because of the Game of You. And here it is the worst possible depiction, you know, especially when at this point in time, depictions of transgender people were few and far between. And this is just like the worst way it could possibly be. And it's so unnecessary.
Yes.
In the context of the story, it doesn't add anything. What it does is, I think, just add another element of like disturbing nature, which this issue has plenty of already. And yeah, I think it's something that I don't know actually what Neil Gaiman thinks about it, but I feel like now is like, wouldn't have if this book was being published now, I don't think, you know, I wouldn't want to say he would be cancelled, but I don't think the book would be as successful as it is, because this panel wouldn't have gone without criticism. And I don't know, maybe it was at the time as well, but yeah, it feels like it really sticks out. And then there's other elements in this story. There's references and depictions of sexual assault. There's references to sex workers being victimized. Plus there is blood and gore, and like quite, you know, the Corinthian pops up, and we can talk about him as the like next segue, like the particularly gory element of him.
So the Corinthian is a serial killer. He's the walking nightmare, who is also a serial killer, who's at this convention. He has a thing about eyes, and eventually, I think, we get the reveal what happens when he takes off his dark glasses, don't we?
He has teeth where his eyes should be.
Teeth for eyes, which is a horrific nightmare moment. But this issue is difficult. And, it, you know, like in the last volume, 24 Hours was the one I wasn't looking forward to. And this one, again, the collector's issue, I don't look forward to it because it's rough and unpleasant. And then there's that one panel, which just seems so awful. And particularly when we talked about Game of You, because as you said, for transgender people, violence is such an awful part. You know, they are much more likely to be the victims of violence. And so it does really stand out as a very unpleasant panel from 30 years ago, doesn't it?
It really does. And I think, and there's more in this book that we'll touch on briefly, probably, that also stands out as quite horrible. But that you can at least say that that stuff is in service of some kind of plot.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just background detail. And I think that's what's really disappointing and hard to read, because it's like, didn't serve anything. We got no real information. You know, it was just a sort of grim, it was just, again, like 24 Hours, a sort of, is this the worst thing you can imagine? is this the worst thing you can write down on paper? And that's kind of the vibe that I get from it, which is, yeah, very disappointing. And to come after Hobgadlin's issue, where we've just had this like very wonderful thing about friendship, this like tale through the ages, which, you know, it's just, it's kind of like the opposite of The Sound of Her Wings. This is not the like fresh air, this is like welcome to hell kind of situation.
Yeah.
Which is ironic for a comic book that literally takes us to hell at other points. Like, in this case, hell is very much on earth and not great at all.
And I wonder, I mean, I do wonder if it was somewhat of a reaction to this that made Neil Gaiman create the character later on of Wanda, which we'll get to in A Game of You, who is, thankfully, as you say, a much more positive portrayal of a trans person.
Well, it's an actual portrayal of a transgender person, whereas this is a portrayal of a dead body, which is, I think, a very different...
Yes.
Very different situation.
Okay, so let's say it's a difficult issue, collectors. We don't want to spend too much time on it because it is such grim stuff. Particularly, as you say, when up until then, the story of Hobgadlin had been quite, been very engaging. And the story of Rose Walker, I liked it. You know, I loved the sort of shared household and these interesting characters. And then she goes on a road trip with Gilbert, where unfortunately she ends up in this issue. Perhaps we should move on towards the end of this one and get to the actual events of the Dream Vortex.
Yeah.
Because we then get a couple of issues called Into the Night and finally Lost Hearts, where we see the Dream Vortex is actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a night of dreams in the shared household. And we sort of, I suppose we walk through everybody in the household's dream, don't we?
We do, and we sort of learn a little bit about them. I think that's, again, it's like I said, when we were talking about book one, I really love the bits where we get just a snippet of a dream.
Yeah.
And you sort of get the sort of creativity that Neil Gaiman is capable of in sort of like, and his artists as well, to be able to like capture the essence of a dream just using words and images. Yeah, I think it's really impressive. And the like differences between all the dreams and the way they flow as language and visuals.
And you're quite right. We do get Chantel and Zelda. It's very much implied that they're a couple in this, this one. I think it was Rose, like myself, who was confused in an early issue whether they were.
I think they're introduced as a sort of like, it's a sort of offhand comment from someone that they could be sisters, could be in a relationship. Who knows? And it's like, well, maybe we know.
And we get a bit more about Hal the landlord, and we get Ken and Barbie.
Yeah, we learn about, I think Hal, again, is one of those little side characters, is a little bit underused, but we hadn't really mentioned that Hal is also a drag queen. And so we meet his drag queen persona, I think, earlier on in the books.
Yes.
Yeah, and so here he's dreaming about Judy Garland.
And Marilyn.
Which is a little bit stereotypical, but it
Bessie
works.
Davis, I think, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we see Ken is dreaming these sort of like 80s yuppie dreams about money.
Yes, they're very 80s, aren't they? He's, you know,
yeah,
he's dreaming of yuppie money, sex, power, isn't he?
Money, sex, power, yeah. And then Barbie has this, like, rich fantasy world, which will become part of A Game of You. And this sort of, like, she's a princess, and she's got, like, a companion, like, a little, like, dog animal, or big dog animal companion.
Martin
Chantel is having this, like...
Yeah,
Chantel's having this sort of... I don't know what you call sort of like a linguistic dream, which I feel is like a very good representation of those kind of dreams you have where you get stuck in a loop of thought that doesn't actually make any sense in reality, but in dream logic, it makes complete sense. So it's about her like having a relationship with a sentence. And then Zelda is having what appears to be a kind of like slightly traumatic, like childhood nightmare almost that relates to her sort of spider thing and her relationship with Chantel. And she's sort of like, she looks very much like Alice in Wonderland, sort of illustration. She's got like stripy tights and a little dress. So yeah, we see these like, these interesting varied characters and these interesting varied dreams, and it's good.
It is very good.
Writing. It's good writing and it's good art.
And then we find out basically Rose Walker, this is all because Rose Walker is the Dream Vortex, and Gilbert, who knows Morpheus, who knows Dream, knows that in order to stop the Vortex, Dream's going to have to kill Rose. And that sets up the final issue in this run.
Oh, yeah, we find out that Gilbert is a Dream as well.
He's also a Dream as well. And one of the this is where we find the various escaped Arcana, or Arcana, I think, as Lucian calls them, the dreams that are missing. Mm. Brute and Glob, the Corinthian, and Gilbert, who is Fiddler's Dream.
Yeah.
Spoilers. So at the end, because I know this is, there's been some rough stuff with the collector's issue about, you know, violence and abuse and sexual violence. And we return in a way to the character of Unity Kincaid, who slept through most of the 70 years that Dream was incarcerated in the first volume.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that she was raped while she was asleep. We get something about, I know from your notes, we get something about surviving abuse and moving on from it towards the end of this.
Yeah, we didn't mention, but at the end of the collector's issue, Rose also is sexually assaulted by one of the serial killers. And it's quite a violent depiction. It is stopped, thankfully, by the intervention of Dream. But then she moves from that point. She's still looking for her little brother. Oh, no, they found Jed, but there's sort of this, like, almost downtime where Jed is in a coma, and I believe Unity is also close to dying, and there's this sort of, like, both Rose and her mother are sort of torn between whose bedside they're sitting at, basically.
Yes.
So you have this downtime. And Jed, we also find out, has been being abused as well. He's being mistreated and kept in a basement while his guardians collect his child support money. And then as the story progresses, we find Rose is the vortex, and this idea that Dream has to kill her. And by the end of it, sort of, yeah, I feel like I'm jumping over a few things, but this idea of being a survivor, what I wanted to talk about was, like, she comes out of this, and the final issue, or the final pages of the final issue, we see her after all of this has happened. And I think her story is very much framed in these pages as someone who's been through something. And I feel like the weight in the story is placed on the fact that she has been through this dream trauma. Like, something weird happened in her dream, and she reacts to it like a normal person. Well, you know, like an average person would, in that, like, she had a weird dream. She doesn't see the significance so much of, like, what actually happened. But I think you can read her story as also a person who's survived abuse, because she survived this assault at the hands of one of the serial killers. And she also survives this dream trauma. And there's a legacy of that, like, sort of connection with her grandmother, who we also understand is, like, survived assault, and her little brother, who's survived this abuse. And there's sort of this depiction of the ways in which they are carrying on with their lives after that. And so we see her in this sort of very depressive state, talking about, like, being 6 months and she hasn't left her room. She's trying to piece stuff together. She's, like, missing Gilbert, I think, and she's living with her mum and her little brother. And she refers to Judy, her friend who we met in book one, who's also died. And so there's just, like, this, I think she's a very well-written character. And I think this is a particularly well-written scene and depiction of a survivor, even though it's a depiction of someone who survived both sexual assault and this sort of fantastical assault almost. And I think, you know, we talked earlier in book one about how women were treated, and how sort of not many of them survived their stories. And here we see, although we see a character who has been put in very difficult situations, we also see the first woman to survive, and the first woman to survive in a way that is realistic and not like a happy ending, not just like a perfect tied up in a bow. And again, it might be one of the reasons why we dislike Dream so much, is because we understand Rose, you know, like, we understand how tough this situation is and how badly he handled that, maybe, you know.
Yes.
And not to keep talking about this too much, but we briefly mentioned Lita, Hippolyta.
Yeah.
Who is, so is she a DC character as well?
I'm afraid she is, yes.
Okay.
Hippolyta,
so she's
Hall.
The wife.
Do you know what her super, shall I tell you what her superhero name was?
Please do.
She was Fury.
Oh.
I know, of course. And that's going to be, that's foreshadowing, so.
Mm.
Yes.
So she is the wife of this other, this, like, superhero Sandman character who's in Jed's dreaming with Brute and Glob. And I don't think we want to get into too much how her story evolves, because it will come really crucial as we talk about later books.
Yeah.
But at the end of when that story is wrapped up, when that version of that little, I think it's like a microcosm of dreaming or something
that
Brute and Glob have created. When that all breaks down, we discover that this superhero figure is actually already dead. And so he was a literal dream. He was like a conjured thing. But she is very much alive and pregnant. And I believe there is literally a scene where we see her literally left in this like rubble of a house.
Yes.
Crying. Yeah. Yeah, she's left in the basement crying, having discovered that she's been like trapped in this weird dreaming world, that she is, her husband is dead, she's still pregnant. And I think Dream sets up this idea that the child has lived in dreaming so long that belongs to him, and he walks away from her telling her that, and she is literally left in the rubble being like, you won't take my baby.
Yeah.
And I think again we see like her story will become later, and we'll talk about her like survival, but again a classic example of Dream being a really bad dude.
Yes.
Sometimes, and there is no like John Constantine or like Hob Gadlin here to be like maybe don't leave this
maybe
woman crying
don't walk
in a basement
away from her, leaving her in the rubble of her life. Yeah,
I wonder how many times we're gonna say this as we through the book, because I can definitely think of a few where we're gonna be like, "Yep," and he walks away from her as well, and also her, and she is crying, and he leaves.
I think we're going to talk about it a few times, because he is.
I think we are.
Yeah, he is. He is a. You know, we talked about this ages ago when we did the Game of You podcast, and we are going to get back to a Game of You. But he is quite. He's not quite. He is a toxic male, isn't he? He's quite.
Yeah.
And he does tend to just walk out of situations without any thought to the consequences or what he's leaving behind him. He just sort of moves on, but other people obviously don't and can't. So we will come back to Hippolyta, or Lita Hall, as she's called. Yeah, she is another reused character, but marvellously so.
Can't believe it. I feel like I've been lied to. Yeah. I think that's why, and that's why Rose's story is quite important, because we see what happens to her after she's had a run-in with Dream, and we don't often see that in the run of the books. And she does, I should say, she does have a like positive ending. I wouldn't say it's like a happy ending, but she has a positive sort of, she collects herself and she dyes her hair, and which is always a significant moment.
It's always a marker
in pop culture.
Yes.
Yeah, always a marker when someone gives themselves a haircut or dyes their hair, and she does both. And then she sort of comes back and engages with her family again, and that's seen as the like, that her story ends on a positive note, which I'm very glad for, even if it goes through some rough stuff.
Okay. So that's the Doll's House, which is, you know, as I say, it feels like Sandman, because it starts to move the story on and you get these people having encounters. Do you remember from, I think from our Game of You talk before, there's a line where you said, one of the characters says, we've fallen down a rabbit hole and ended up in Stephen King's basement. And it's a bit like that for Rose Walker and her associates in this run. But anyway.
Yeah, very much so.
This wasn't necessarily something we were going to do for every collection. But I mean, in the first volume, obviously, everybody's favourite episode or issue is The Sound of Her Wings. And our worst one was 24 Hours. And we know which is our worst episode or from A Doll's House.
Yeah.
What's the favourite one?
I think the Hob Gadlin is probably the standout. I do enjoy the rounding up of Rose's story. That last issue, I think, because it is that sort of like culmination of everything. But I think as a standalone issue, Hob Gadlin's is the one that like sets a marker.
Yeah.
But other stuff that's going to come later as well.
It does. And I mean, we're going to talk about it a bit more when we come back next time on Dream Country. But it also does feel a little bit like an issue, a single issue you could hand to a new reader and say, you know,
this is this world.
Yes. Here we have, you know, read The Sound of Her Wings and then read Men of Good Fortune. and you're going to get an introduction to dream and death and this world and some of the fantastical elements of it, but also some of the very sort of human everyday life elements of it, which are so, to me, so exciting and gripping when you read the comic.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else to add on The Doll's House?
I don't think so. It's got some rough moments, but I think there's a lot in it that feels like the classic Sandman, you know, the one that you sort of remember when you remember the whole thing. Yeah. It has that feeling, like you said, of the narrative that's focused on Rose, with Dream as this kind of background character slightly, who comes in and out of people's lives. That becomes the sort of hallmark of the story as it progresses. And I think that's really another good place maybe to start people would be with book two. Basically, start people anywhere other than the first book or the last book, is what I think we're saying. Like, don't bring them in at the end, but also don't put them straight in at the beginning. Yeah. And you'll find a better route through.
And we'll find out perhaps more about another good starting point next time when we come back on A Handful of Dust, because we'll be talking about volume 3, which is
Dream Country.
And it's going to be a short one, but it's going to be... Yeah. There's some memorable issues in there. I think it's just 4 stories we've got to, haven't we?
I think so, yeah. I don't have mine to hand right here, but yeah.
Okay. So that will come up on the next episode. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny.
And goodbye.
Goodbye.